From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Lori Natero was born in Brooklyn, New York, raised in Phoenix, and then now lives in Oregon. She's the author of The Idiot Girls Action Adventure Club, Autobiography of a Fat Bride, We Thought You'd Be Prettier, and There's a Slight Chance I Might Be Going to Hell. She's the guest of the Thurber House as part of their Always Excellent Author Series, and her latest book is Spooky Little Girl. Welcome to Writer Talk, Lori Natero.
Thank you, Doug. It's nice to meet you.
It's great to have you here. So tell me about this book, and tell me about the writing of this book. I'll do the setup that there's a young woman who has some problems in her personal life, mm-hmm. and then has sort of the ultimate problem in her personal life, and then mm-hmm. it ends. Or maybe that resolves the problems in the personal life.
There's some problems in between, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I read on your website that you actually came upon this story, I think, in the dental chair.
Yeah, I was getting my teeth cleaned.
Right. So mm-hmm. that is another reason why writers should practice good hygiene.
I completely
so
agree.
So they get their stories, and that's where all the best writers get their stories. That's why Steve Martin was a dentist in that one movie, right?
Oh.
Because he's a writer.
The Secret Lives of Dentists, yeah.
Right. So how much, when you're writing a story like this, how much active or creative license do you get to take with somebody's life? What is it for you as a writer?
That's a good question. In this particular story, it was based on a friend of my dental hygienist who she had known. She went to dental school with her. And she came, this girl, Lucy, who's my main character, went to vacation to Hawaii, came back, and found all of her worldly possessions thrown out onto the street from the house that she shared with her boyfriend. No explanation, nothing. So to kind of shorten the story down, she decided to move in with her sister, stayed away, and she moved, and her friends never heard from her again. And what ended up happening is she got there, and a day later, her sister's truck broke down. She borrowed Lucy's truck. Lucy took the bus into their downtown, mm-hmm. walked off the bus, and got hit by a truck and was killed. Mm-hmm. And in the process, and I know that that's not funny.
This is a comedy.
It's
right.
a comedy. Yeah. It's a screwball comedy. Right, exactly. In the process of that, you know, like her cell phone was destroyed and things like that. This is a true story. Her friends never heard from her again. And they thought that she was just kind of being flaky. That was one of Lucy's issues. She was kind mm-hmm. of flaky, fly by the seat of your pants kind of girl. So at first, it didn't seem odd. She was just kind of gone. And then after some time had passed, Jody, my dental hygienist, looked her up on Google and discovered her obituary. Mm-hmm. But in my mind, that kind of said to me how odd it was that no matter how plugged in we are with technology and the internet and email and texting and chatting and all that stuff with Facebook, given the right set of circumstances, anybody can completely slip through the cracks mm-hmm. and really essentially never be heard from again. And if you're not looking, that can easily happen.
Well, that's the destruction of the cell phone. Once that's gone,
right.
nobody would hear
yeah,
from you again.
Exactly. And if her sister didn't have access to her email, she really wouldn't know how to get, you know, how to contact her friends.
Which is actually brought, the email is discovered by the son. It's
right.
always the children hacking the computers. Nice blame. I enjoyed the way that you blamed the younger generation for that, or gave them credit for the discovery.
Right,
depending
exactly.
Depending on how you look at it.
Exactly.
So I think you've got an excerpt that you're going to read.
Oh, certainly,
and
yes.
And do a
yes,
little
yes,
bit
yes.
about that, since it's at the beginning-ish of the book.
It is. I need to set it up a little bit, just so it's understandable. Basically, Lucy, the main character, has woken up in what she believes to be a dorm, or possibly like a county hospital. She mm-hmm. knows that she's been in an accident, but she's not really sure what's going on. She's given instructions by like a receptionist to go to a certain room down the hall, and when she goes into that room, there's a bunch of people sitting there. There's a girl in a wetsuit, there's a guy in a bike helmet, there's another lady in like a pink velvet, like a kind of like running suit. There's a guy in a Tommy Bahama, like, you know, vacation shirt. And so while she's sitting there, an older woman comes in and she announces that she is their instructor. She tells them that they are all dead and that this is basically where they are now. So I will pick up from right there. Okay. And so this is the instructor speaking to them, to our students. Now, I realize what I may have just said seems like a terribly turbulent way to start our acquaintance, Ruby informed the speechless and stunned group before her. But after guiding countless sections of the freshly expired through their transitions, I found that being upfront, first and foremost, is not only the most effective method, but the most helpful. You're dead. You've all died very unexpectedly, and my job is to assist you with your initial transition. This is Intro to Sudden Death, a primer for this particular stage in the death process. Do you mean denial, bargaining, and acceptance? The bicyclist wondered. If I died, where are my already dead family members? Tommy Bahama asked. I thought they were all supposed to show up and throw me a party. I want to speak to your manager, the housewife cried in a panic. I demand to see Jesus and his mother. I don't understand where we are, Bethany said, still in shock that her vacation of snorkeling had ended so abruptly. I'm confused. Listen, Ruby interjected, trying to calm things. We have a lot of ground to cover, so let's clear up some confusion. You're in the transition center. That's where you woke up this morning, in the dormitory. That's where you'll be staying until our section is complete. I'll be handing out room assignments before you leave. Oh, that is ridiculous, the Snow Bunny housewife objected. So you're saying I'm dead and I'm staying in a dorm, like in college? I gained 15 pounds in that dorm. And I'll tell you right now, if there's some nosy body RA sniffing around, I'm not discussing my eating habits with anyone. I demand an upgrade. I'll pay for it. I have plenty of frequent flyer miles. There are no upgrades, I'm afraid, Ruby informed her. This is all we've got. Everyone gets the same thing. There's no sliding scale. What the heck is a sudden death transition center? Lucy thought as she sat back and watched the reactions of the others around her, almost as if it was a television show that she was just tuning into. Could she really be dead? She wondered, then immediately wanted to smack herself for being so foolish. It was a dream. The whole thing was bizarre enough to be a dream, and once she realized that she was trapped in the reality show portion of her subconscious, she decided that she should simply sit back, enjoy the show, and wait until she woke up. It was like free entertainment. After all, there are worse dreams to be stuck in. She could have been making out with Carrot Top or being chased through a mall by a bear with a goat head, all while trying to figure out a way to stop at the food court to get a beef and cheddar at Arby's without getting mauled. Truly, this was a great dream. The detail was amazing. The premise was fascinating. She was already looking forward to recalling the whole bizarre episode to her sister Alice in the morning over their first cups of coffee.
Okay, very nice. So you touch on a number of themes just in that excerpt that will come up throughout the book. And the one I was really taken with was this version of death is a remarkably religion-less version of death.
It's very secular.
Yeah, it's sort of metaphysical, but there's mm-hmm. no, you know, there your conceptions of heaven, although there's a place beyond this that they then go to.
Right.
If you do everything right as a ghost, it's your second chance, as you say, to get the things right in life. I'm always fascinated by ghosts. Are those people getting second chances?
Right.
You know? So all the people that do it well, just psh, get it. But tell me about how you worked out some of the things that you were writing about in here, because at one level, right, it's comedic, but you have to have a structure under that. And I think that structure probably relates to some of your own thoughts as an author and, you know, take on religion as an author.
Sure.
At least you sort of address this on your website, maybe more so
right.
than in the book.
Well, I was raised as a Catholic, and I'm rather lapsed now, but but I was raised with this idea of you die and you go to heaven, and then you just hang out with all these people that you like. And so when I was trying to create this version of my ever after, or whatever you want to call it, in the book it's called The State. It's mm-hmm. actually The State of Elated Bliss, which in Webster's Dictionary is the definition of nirvana. So that's where I got that. I try to think, what would this place be like that I would really want to hang out? Because eternity is a really long time.
Right.
And that would be
and
a really long time.
And you made it a dorm
time.
Room.
Well, right. Yeah, exactly. Part of that, yeah, the school before you get to the eternity is, there's a dorm there. But I thought, if I'm going to be hanging out with my mom forever and ever and ever, there's got to be some fun stuff going on. You know what I mean? So in my mind, I just kind of thought, what would be the best way, what would my idea of heaven kind of be like? And it was just basically everything was great. It was in your perfect house with the people that you loved, eating brownie batter with your finger.
So. Uh-huh, okay. And that's another one of the themes that comes back in a lot of food. Metaphors come into your books and in some of your other writing. And
I'm Italian, so.
There's some ambivalence, though. You know, you get to eat in heaven and you don't gain weight.
Right.
But there's also, I don't think that the people don't seem particularly interested in it.
Right.
Somehow you sort of lose that as you
exactly.
transition in, which seems almost like purgatory. So I was curious about that. Is that a take on that? It's like, you can eat all you want, you don't gain any weight, but there's no real enjoyment to it.
Well, in a sense, because I figured if these ghosts aren't really physical, then you have no need for the physical things. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You don't really need to even be able to breathe, because all you are is you're a mass of energy. You've just changed forms. And in order to manifest, they actually have to draw energy from other areas on the spectral plane, like toasters and light bulbs. And in one instance, Lucy grabs the refrigerator to get a particular huge bolt of energy. So
there was a lot of kitchen imagery there too, by the way. It's always toasters, ovens, refrigerators.
That's where most of our stuff is plugged in. Mm-hmm. You know, TVs, kind of stuff like that. So with the food, I kind of thought ghosts aren't, no one ever sees a ghost chowing down on like a hoagie. No one sees ghosts at Quiznos, you know, like eating their hearts out. So to me, it made sense that ghosts didn't eat. But when they originally go to the transition center to make their transition easier, they have these things that are available to these people, to these spirits, to make it seem like they're going through their daily routines as a matter of ritual.
Right.
You get up, you have coffee, you have a bagel, that kind of thing. But essentially, they don't need them.
And you have to choose an outfit to be a ghost. You have to go through and decide what you're going to be. And you've got names for some of the stereotypical ones, the white lady. There's a bordello costume that's sort of unexpectedly chosen.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting in terms of also not only do you not really get to eat, but you don't get to change clothes. You sort of get stuck after
you
your
do.
Transition.
Once you choose, that's it. That's it for eternity. Yeah.
Now, on your website, you say that you're... that you haven't seen a ghost, if I'm interpreting this correctly, but you'd love to hear about it if people did. Am I interpreting? It's a bit ambiguous on the site.
I'm fascinated by ghosts. And if there is honestly, I might get some trouble for this, a true dedicated science to studying ghosts, I would enroll back in grad school right now and study it. I am so fascinated by ghosts, and I always have been. And there have been some incidences in my life that I can't explain, yet I'm not fully prepared to go and say, I saw a ghost. I saw some weird things. I don't know what it was. It looked like a man. Someone was slamming my door open and shut, and there was no one there. This is when I was little. But I'm not going to say I was haunted. You see what I mean?
Right.
So while I really enjoy the idea of ghosts, I'm not the same as Bigfoot. I love the idea of Bigfoot, but I'm not ready to put my foot out there and say,
okay,
I believe in Bigfoot.
And that's the next story, is you're going to write about Bigfoot, because you got that as the idea. As a parent, I can tell you that what was slamming your door was probably a sibling. Because you describe all the pinching and the poking and the prodding and the pain that you experience with your siblings. And I wanted to read this one part.
Oh, yay. That's great.
This is you describing going on vacation with your family out of The Idiot Girl and the Flaming Tantrum of Death. So this is describing where your mother would have you stay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To make matters even more closely resemble the comfort level of Guantanamo Bay, my mother consistently struck a claim for one of the double beds as we entered the room by throwing her purse on it, digging out her bottle of Tylenol and her pack of Winston's, and then sprawling out with her eyes closed and her hand over her head. This not only left the rest of the family one bed for cramped quarters, but created an undeniable bounty of opportunity for pinching, slapping, and pushing between my sisters and me, and sometimes even my dad, to which my mother would respond by roaring from her yacht of a bed 2 feet away, "Shut up, all of you. If you people haven't noticed, I'm on vacation." And so I'm curious about, how does your family respond to your essays? You've got your fans, but that's maybe not the best description of a family vacation.
Oh, she's
it's
not
honest.
Pleased.
Yes, she's not pleased. Okay.
She's not pleased at all, but this is what I do for a living. And honestly, if she really wanted me to stop writing about the funny things that she does, she's got to stop doing those things. And she can't. It's just ingrained in her. That's my mother. You know, that's the way she is. So that's what I told her. I said, either you can pay my mortgage, or you can just never speak a word to me again, and we're completely
There's no
dead.
Emotional blackmail there. There's no...
She's been doing it for, my entire adolescence and childhood. Okay. So now it's my
all
turn.
Right. Well, that's good. So since you're, we do that, and everybody apparently is still speaking to you because you've got, Well, because you've also got, you describe going in the first essay in here, going to a hotel and unexpectedly finding, or a lodge and a cabin, and unexpectedly finding your sister there.
Right.
Because they're hiding, she's sort of hiding from you, and you've got this idea that other people that are at the area are also are bandits at some point because they're so strange, they're bird watchers.
Something was up, something right. was funny, right.
We'll return to my guest in a minute. You're listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University on WCRS, Columbus's only community radio station. Don't forget that you can always watch our videos at writerstalk.org or on facebook.com/writerstalk.
So I'm curious about how often you create these sort of little dramas throughout your life in order to have that fiction. Which comes first? Is it the propensity to see odd behavior that leads to the stories, or do the stories sort of force you to look at behavior and think, what could I do with that? What's the deal as a writer?
I think that's a really good question, too. And I would say that my life is really no different from anyone else's life, but when I became a newspaper reporter, and even prior to that, I think that anybody can have the same situation. It depends on how you look at it, if you find humor in that, or if it's completely just dull and boring. I tend to find humor in stuff like that, especially really embarrassing situations. I love to be able to fall down in a supermarket, have my skirt fly up, and be able to laugh about it. The fact that I get to write about in a book is just cream on the top for me, you know.
This must be very comfortable for your husband if you're going out and doing all these things.
No, I don't ever do anything intentionally. I never do anything intentionally because that ruins it. Then you won't get an organic response. Mm-hmm. And then you ruin your results. It's like trying to rig a science experiment. You know what I mean? You have to let things unfold. Right. So in no instance will I will sometimes, this is true, egg my mother on. I will sometimes do that in a conversation. Mm-hmm. But
that's
as far as
technique to use as an author.
I won't really lead her, but if she says something egregious or ridiculous, instead of just letting it go and think, oh my God, that's my mother, I will answer her and I will kind of keep it going.
You know,
just
kind
of see where
it goes.
Right. Sometimes it turns out,
as a form of vengeance.
Writing as vengeance.
There's a line in here where I think she's critiquing your gymnastics and says, gymnasts don't have legs that touch in the middle or something like that. And you think, well, maybe not the nicest thing.
I was 10, you know, and I was born with chubby little thighs, and those are her genes. They're, you know, I got them from her.
Well, it's
so.
Important thing is that you know who to blame as an author.
Blame is 90% of the scenario. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, I've read that you referred to as sort of the dirty-mouthed Irma Bombeck. But tell me, who is your biggest influence? I know that you never met Irma Bombeck. You do some different things. But who's a really big influence on the way that you write?
I honestly grew up reading her. And I grew up in Arizona. And she lived in Arizona, too. And even though I never met her, working at the paper, I went to go work for the paper that she went to go work for. And as a result of that, I met many of her old friends who were in TV and stuff like that. Because I kind of feel like I know her. So she was a tremendous influence. And I think she also really helped shape the way that I perceive things and my perception. So even though I was 10 years old and reading Irma Bombeck, I think that she was a massive influence on me.
Okay.
And another thing is, and this is going to sound crazy, but I also was very obsessed with the Laura Ingalls Wilder books and the way she told stories about her family.
Now,
and
how do you draw a parallel with Laura Ingalls Wilder, who I don't recall ever finding a stray hair in the bathroom and being upset about it? So what's the connection with Laura Ingalls Wilder?
I love the way that she told stories, and that was what made me want to become a writer, was reading her stories and the way that she told stories and the way that she drew me into her life and the way that I kind of became a part of her family, even as a little girl. So as far off as that is, that's the way it was. As far as humor, I didn't really read anybody apart from Irma Bombeck growing up. And I started doing this humor column, when I was in high school. It was terrible. It was not funny. But that's when I started kind of on this path, was, you know, a really long time ago.
Well, tell me about your development as a writer. We'll go back there and say,
sure.
If you say it was bad then, what changed you? How did you start becoming good?
I think it was just like anything else. Like when you're a carpenter, when you start out, you're going to end up hitting your thumb a bunch of times and turning it black.
Right.
And I certainly, I did that many, many, many times with writing my stuff. I didn't have my timing down then. I didn't have my rhythm down. I didn't have my placement down or my perspective or my voice. I think as the more you practice, honestly, and I think that the same is about this trade, about this career, than it is in any other trade. The more you do it, the more practice you get. You're going to find not your shortcuts, but you're going to be able to smooth things out easier. You're going to know how to kind of ease into that curve or miter that corner.
Okay.
You know what
now
I mean?
That, I mean, that's general. I'm curious. Tell me something specific about how you've changed as a writer. How did you get that rhythm? So, because I teach writing occasionally, mm-hmm. very infrequently, and and never humor writing. But what would you say to people writing? You know, how do you, when you give feedback, what's a really common form of feedback to somebody who wants to be, say, a humor writer?
Humor writing is, if I may be so bold, I think it's different and perhaps a little more difficult to eventually find your groove. And that, again, is just by trial and error. And the process that I go through, and I think the process in the short term and also in the long term of my entire career is almost exactly the same, is telling a story and watching people respond to your story. And then you begin to be able to pick up on your timing, improve it by seeing how people are reacting to you. Because it's a very insular thing when you're writing humor. You don't have an audience out there to try out your material on.
So you don't ever read it to your husband to test out material?
When you say
watching the audience, how do you
right.
do that? What's your mechanism?
What I do is I know that I have a nugget there, a bit, if you will, or some material. When I come home from the store, something's happened, and I tell my husband the story. Oh my God, you won't believe what happened to me. And if I tell him, and then I might call my sister and tell her. And then I might tell my best friend Jamie, and then I might find myself telling that story at maybe a happy hour or a dinner party. And my husband was the one who actually realized this. He's like, you're practicing for writing your stuff. That's what you're doing. You're trying out your material. You're getting your rhythm. You're getting your timing and your punchlines. That's how you're getting your stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right. That I finally realized that was my process. That's how I begin to figure out how to put a piece together.
So now you charge people at that. you make them pay you.
Or don't go out to dinner with us anymore.
Okay.
You're going to tell us all these stupid stories.
Right. And you know, and you've got the story in here with your friend Jamie where a bird flies over and relieves itself on her, in her hair. And I think the telling part about that bit is that you're more upset that you had to throw away the food than you are with your friend.
He kept eating it. And I finally had to pull it out of his hands and throw it away. He was a medical doctor. He knew better than that. There's parasites in that. But yes, I was very upset. It was good food. You waited in line a long time.
What's the best part of being a writer for you? You've talked about getting people's reactions. Is it getting people's reactions outside, or is it writing the good? Is it when you're practicing your bit, getting a good reaction, or doing it at home and writing it, and then feeling that you have that encapsulated?
Well, I think that it's aspects of all of those things. I genuinely enjoy what I do. I wouldn't say that I make myself laugh, but when I am reliving these experiences that I've had with my friends and family, and they genuinely, to me, are funny, and that means that I get to laugh at work.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't get any more... A leprechaun doesn't have a better job, and he gets to hang out with a pot of gold. You know what I mean?
Right. So, but they don't get to spend it, the leprechauns, you know.
Right,
no,
well...
I'm just moving the metaphor past them. Final question. You refer to writing fiction as, and I'm paraphrasing slightly here
sure.
because we're on PBS, making stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems partly like your fiction is a natural outgrowth of the hyperbole that you use as part of the humorous essays. Mm-hmm. But you write on the website that writing your first novel was scary as heck. Again, paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you worked through that. Tell me how you worked through the fear that it's not going to do it. I know at some point you say you just have to do it. But how do you psych yourself up? I'm thinking like of students of mine that have difficulty with writing. How do I get them past that? I said, well, Laura Natero does this. You can do this.
Well, it was never my idea to do a fiction book, ever, ever, ever. I was a trained journalist, and I worked mm-hmm. as a reporter for a zillion years. And so when Random House, is my publisher, came to me during my second book deal and said, we want you to do a novel, I said, you are out of your mind. There's no way that I don't even know what you're talking about. That is just career suicide for me. No, I won't do it. And the next book deal that I got, they let that one go. And then the next book deal that I got, they said, okay, well, you're going to write a book of essays and a novel, and this is the deal, and either you take it or you don't. And so I thought, I didn't have a choice here. But my editor, I trusted him, and he was a fantastic editor, Bruce Tracy, wonderful, wonderful man. And I said, you really have to help me out with this. And he said, you're thinking it's too much. He's like, you write 18 little novels in a book. You just take that novel and you make it a whole, that story, and you make it a whole story. And then you can put your little stories in as B and C and D stories. And that's how you put it together. It's just, you're already doing it. You just need to kind of stretch it out and give them more stuff to do. And once I sat down and actually thought about it, it became much easier. And certainly in my first novel, which is There's a Slight Chance I Might Be Going to Hell, there are things that I would change in that now that I have more practice at it. And I took that experience, and I think that I did not a better job, but I really made sure that this one was plotted out perfectly. The other one was a crazy, crazy book. Mm-hmm. This one is, the narrative is much more streamlined and direct.
Did you do that? Did you write an outline?
I wrote an outline. I had a map. I had a bulletin board with index cards. I had everything. Yeah. Okay. Everything. It was like almost like a map of Risk, the board game. It, mm-hmm. it kind of looked like that with different strategies going here and there and arrows. Had to get it down. So it was a good experience.
Did you try that out on your husband and say, what do you think of this map? Or Jamie, the friend Jamie? Or was that was too personal at that point?
No, Jamie, I don't bother with this stuff. But with my husband.
Because that would be inconveniencing her, whereas with someone you're married to.
Well, my husband is kind of part of the deal. It's his job. You know, okay. All of a sudden I would be at dinner, I'd be like, oh my God, it's an elevator. It's an elevator. And he'd be like, what are you talking about? I'm just like, the way that they get down from up there to down there, it's the elevator. It would click, and then I would understand, and he wouldn't, you know. Or I'd be at dinner, I'd be like, oh, this is what needs to happen. Nola needs to be able to do this and this and this. And mm-hmm. so he experienced that part, but he really never knew what I was talking about. I think that he thought I was drinking a lot.
Which you allude to many times.
I'm better now.
Okay. Something like the having all the vices, mm-hmm. you know, that you're putting away. And also, he doesn't get the vice of cake and sweets, because you one of your big problems that I read in here is that he doesn't eat sweets.
He's not a dessert guy.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happened, but he's not a dessert guy. So I'm always the fat, curly-haired girl eating dessert by herself, a big, fat piece of cake, and he just sits there and waits until I'm done. So it's rather awkward, but that's the situation.
Okay. What genre haven't you written that you'd like to try? What else is, what's next? I think you're working on a novel. Are you working on one more novel?
I'm back to doing essays. Okay. But then I've got two more ideas for a novel that I really would like to work on after I'm done with this. But as far as genres, in this book, I hit a little bit of everything. There's a little bit of romance. There's a little bit of sci-fi. There's humor. Mm-hmm. There's ladies lit, whatever you want to call it. I'm really liking the sci-fi thing. Okay. Or just kind of like the out of this world, different dimension kind of stuff. Okay. I'm kind of into that now.
All right, well, we'll be looking for that, the next book. Lori Natero, Spooky Little Girl is the new book, and it's recently out. Mm-hmm. And I wish you all the luck in the world with that. And
thank you
for being here on Writer's Talk.
Thank you, Doug.
From the Center for the Study of Teaching and Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing.
You can also visit writerstalk.org. You'll find listings for our televised episodes from the Ohio Channel, the Columbus Educational Access Channel, and even Buckeye TV if you happen to be an OSU student. Writer's Talk is a production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University in association with the Ohio Channel. Until next time, this is Doug Dangler from high atop Mendenhall Lab at The Ohio State University saying, keep writing.